Hey everybody, join us as we delve into our favorite dark tales and paranormal mysteries.
Venture with us beyond the safe places that exist in daylight as we go
beyond the shadows. True crime.
Paranormal.
Hauntings.
UFOs.
Cryptids and unsolved mysteries.
Conspiracy theories.
Past lives.
Reincarnation.
And all the like are just a few of the topics that we will tackle.
If it haunts your fucking dreams, then it will be on our show.
Shadows where you find me at. You can't see me in the deepest blacks. When your heart starts racing and you see the cracks, all these creepy things that you might attract. All the demons be where the action's at. So listen up if you want it. UFOs, all them ghosts, we got everything that you want. Whoa.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
Hey guys, and welcome back to episode 78 of Beyond the Shadows.
Welcome back, Shadow People. We hope you guys all had an amazing week so far.
Yes, and before we get started into the news, I wanted to mention our friends over at Like Mother Like Murder hit their 100th episode. So they did that live on Instagram.
Congratulations, ladies.
Yes, congratulations on that. You can go over on Instagram and check it out there, or you can go to Apple or any of the podcast places.
Those ladies are amazing.
We love them. They really are. It was a great episode. Go check them out. So what is in the news today, Ryan?
So if you've been paying attention to the news the last couple of years, we've all heard a lot about pilots being too drunk to fly. That's been
standard.
Uncomfortably true. But now that same behavior is spread to wildlife as well. So the day before the eclipse here in North America, which was April 7th, two black vultures were found drunk inside a dumpster in Watertown, Connecticut.
Just shit-faced.
They were hammered. So they were brought to a place. It's actually a place called Hope, which is a rehabilitation center in Killingsworth. But it doesn't say if it's a
They didn't say what kind of rehab they had to go to.
Rehabilitation center or a rehabilitation. It's like the Betty Ford Clinic.
I know. That's it. These guys have had a problem for a while. They ended up in the fucking rehab center.
In the dumpster, they were drinking out of a paper bag.
Yeah, right. Say that.
You got any wine? I'll suck your dick. All right. They didn't say that. Yeah.
He's just assuming.
They might have, though. So the staff there actually said they went from passed out to aggressive and feisty like real fast. So they were out cold, and when they woke up, they were...
We know people like that.
They were angry.
He's a nice friendly drunk until he's not. Yeah,
that tequila doesn't. Yeah, right. Experts said they likely got drunk off of eating fermented fruits in the trash. And apparently for birds, that is not that unusual.
No, there's a lot of animals that get drunk. Some will do it on purpose. I've seen some stuff, though, where moose have gotten drunk. I think there's one that was in, I want to say it was like Finland or something. They probably don't have moose over there.
The apples and shit that are on
the
ground in the forest.
And this moose was stuck in the tree. He like tried to jump through a tree or whatever. And it was like wedged in the V of the tree. It's a big ass moose.
Like 600 pound moose that's drunk. They're mean anyway. So.
Oh, yeah. 600 would be a little one.
Yeah. So also in the news this week, so we get a guy in the UK named Matt Barr.
Matt Barr.
He recently went on the British talk show called This Morning to talk about some of the intense hardships that he's faced.
This poor bastard.
No, his life is hard. So, you know, dating's been difficult. He feels exploited. And he even got kicked out of his yoga class. So, Scott, what's the root of this poor bastard's troubles?
The poor guy has... A 12-inch dong.
Yeah.
It's just dragging him down, man.
Yeah, it's rough. It's rough. So he wears the crown of Britain's biggest penis. He's been crowned that, so clearly he's not shy about whipping it out. You know?
No kidding.
But now he wants sympathy as well. He's running out of ways to work it in the conversation.
No kidding. What it is. Well,
nice day out there. Yeah, Ian, you know, I've got a big dick, too.
I was thrown out of yoga for doing... Downward facing dog. Dong.
Dong. <yeah. laughs>
That poor guy.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, Matt, I've been there. I know how it feels.
Yeah, right.
You step on it a couple dozen times, it stings.
No, you know what? I got a story. It should be a fire pit story, but I was, when I first joined the Air Force, there was a...
don't tell me you had 12.
No, I I could give you 12 if I did it twice.
You had an 80.
So no, I was in the, I is just joined the Air Force and I was in basic training. And in basic training, they've got the showers that are like, it's like four walls and everybody has to use the same shower. Yeah. And I walk in to go to, the, to take a shower and there's like 10 guys on one side and this guy, the dorm chief, is on the other all by himself. And everyone's crowded like on the other side. And I walk in right next to him and he's back to me and he turns around. Dude's got the biggest dick I've ever seen in my life. And everyone was on the other side because nobody wanted to shower next to him. He was under one shower. His dick was under the other. And I had to shower next to him. I look like a fucking 6-year-old.
Was his name Matt Barr?
It was not Matt Barr.
Because he's been suffering his whole life, apparently.
Now, that poor bastard.
Yeah. I feel so bad for you, Matt.
It would be, honest to God, what a pain in the ass it would be. Well, it could be for somebody. No, but I mean, but honestly, hauling that around all the time?
Trust me, it gets old.
Yeah, I bet it does.
I had him lop a couple inches off the top. I mean, my back feels so much better.
It's like having a breast reduction. But
it's rough. Yeah, I donated.
A little off the top, please?
I donated to the needy. So Scott's going to have that attached next week.
Up to 4 inches.
One last story this week. So science has spent a lot of money and time trying to figure out how to cut down on the dangerous greenhouse gases. And here's what they've come up with. Cows are farting too much. Yeah. Plain and simple.
That's been it for a long time.
Plain and simple. So all you guys that eat too much McDonald's, you're killing the environment.
Yeah, for real. We're going to have to do something about this. Oh, they are. They're breeding cows that fart less. Yeah. That's the plan.
So I think what they've done is they've produced like several million bovine butt plugs. They're going to feed them like quinoa. Is it gluten-free bread?
Is it because the methane goes out in the air? Because I was thinking they could put like a pilot light on them and just burn it.
That's exactly what it is. It's the methane. I guess they burp a lot too. They burp and fart, and that contains methane. But the dairy and the beef herds are so big that they're responsible for something like 12% of the dangerous greenhouse gases. So it's not a minuscule amount.
That's a lot to think of. Well, we got to eat, though, yeah, so it's got to come from somewhere.
All this talk about burps and farts has got me craving a Big Mac and a glass of milk.
So, well, what are you going to bring to the table today, Bob?
We're going to do some true crime. Haven't done it in a while.
No, it's been a little bit.
We're going back in time again. You know I like to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
So we're going to do the lipstick killer from the 1940s.
All right, let's do it.
All right, we'll be right back, guys.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
The case of the lipstick killer is now infamous, but when it began, it didn't even make the front page of the local papers. On June 5th, 1945, 43-year-old Josephine Ross was found dead in her home on Chicago's North Side. She had been stabbed 4 times in the neck, and whoever had committed the crime had then covered over the stab wounds with adhesive tape before wrapping her head in a skirt. The apartment had been ransacked and was spattered in blood, but police found no fingerprints, no obvious clues, and no motive. Nothing had apparently been taken from the apartment, so it didn't appear that robbery had been the motive. Police theorized that the killer was probably an intruder unknown to the victim, who had possibly broken in with the intent to burgle the place and didn't expect that anyone was home. When encountering Ross, the perpetrator had panicked, killed her, and then abandoned the crime before taking anything. No strangers had been seen in the vicinity, nor had any strange noises been reported. There were no witnesses to the crime. Police questioned Josephine's fiancé and all of her ex-boyfriends, but they all had rock-solid alibis. Her hand contained a fistful of dark hair, so it was surmised that they were looking for a dark-haired suspect. There wasn't much to go on, and the case quickly became cold. 6 months went by with no further developments. On December 11, 1945, 32-year-old stenographer Frances Brown was found savagely murdered inside the bathroom of her apartment at the Pine Grove Motel. She had a bullet wound in her head, and a bread knife was lodged in her neck. It had been driven in with such force that the blade protruded out of the other side of her neck. So the dude drove a bread knife clear through the neck.
Wow. And those are dull.
Yeah, very.
Wow.
The body was stripped naked and washed clean of any blood. The head had been wrapped again, same as last time, only this time it was wrapped with towels. Once again, there were no fingerprints found.
So what you're saying, the head was like wrapped up, like so they couldn't see the face and all that? Like they wrapped the whole head?
Just the top of the head? The top of the head, yeah.
Okay.
Once again, there were no fingerprints to be found, but this time the killer had left police a message. Someone had written on the living room wall using Brown's red lipstick. In a unique curling scrawl, someone had written, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." The press ate this detail up, and the suspect was named the Lipstick Killer. Police found a bloody fingerprint smudge on the door jamb of the entrance door to the apartment. A witness reported hearing gunshots at around 4 a.m., and the building's night clerk said he saw a nervous-looking man between 35 to 40 getting off the elevator at around this time. Despite these clues, not much came of the investigation. Almost a month later, on the morning of January 7, 1946, James Degnan discovered his 6-year-old daughter, Suzanne, was missing from her bedroom in their apartment. The family lived in a wealthy neighborhood on the city's north side. Degnan called police, and before long, the apartment was crawling with activity. A ladder was found outside her bedroom window, and inside her bedroom, police found a crumpled ransom note. It was poorly spelled and instructed, "Get 20,000 ready and wait for my word. Do not notify the FBI or police. Bills are in fives and tens. Burn this for her safety." A man repeatedly called the house demanding the ransom. Chicago's mayor also received a note. His read, "This is to tell you how sorry I am not to get old Degnan instead of his girl. Roosevelt and the OPA made their own laws. Why shouldn't I? And a lot more." James Degnan was a senior OPA, Office of Price Administration, executive. And there was currently a nationwide meat packers strike. The OPA was talking about extending rationing to include dairy products as well. Another OPA executive had recently been given armed protection for he and his family after his children had been threatened. Recently, a man involved with black market meat sales had been found decapitated in Chicago. And it was thought that maybe the kidnapping was related to the meatpacking strike. So this was a serious deal.
Yeah, this is, I mean, and this crime is completely different than the first two. It's nothing like them. This is a...
No, they're not similar, but they're all, they think, related to the OPA, the meat strike and all that. Because I mean, there's a lot of money changing hands or not changing hands because of the strike. People, and this is not Great Depression, but not too long after it, you know.
Right.
So it turned out that the ransom note was simply a ruse. At 7 p.m. on the same day she was taken, Suzanne's severed head was found floating in a sewer catch basin less than a block away from her home. During the next few hours, her legs and torso were also found in separate sewer basins nearby. Her arms wouldn't be discovered for a month, but they were also inside a sewer catch basin. In a nearby apartment building, police found blood inside the basement laundry tub drains and determined that that had been the crime scene. So the coroner fixed her time of death to have been between 12 and 1 o'clock a.m. the night before she was discovered missing. She had likely died of strangulation and was already dead when she was dismembered.
So wait, she was missing for a whole night before they even...
No, so her father found her missing the next morning when he went to get her. But so her time of death was set the night before. So her father obviously didn't notice her missing She was kidnapped, and he didn't notice her until the next morning.
Sick fucker.
So the coroner's expert stated that the killer was, quote, either a man who worked in a profession that required the study of anatomy or one with a background in dissection. Not even the average doctor could be as skillful. It had to be a meat cutter, end quote. The coroner added that it was also, another quote, very clean job with absolutely no signs of hacking.
Yeah.
So, in their estimation, you've got somebody that's got some medical knowledge here that you should be looking for.
Or a meat packer.
Or, yeah, somebody with some cutting knowledge.
Uh-huh.
Police quickly arrested 65-year-old Hector Verberg, who worked as a janitor in the building where the Degnans lived. The police told the press, quote, this is the man, despite the fact that he had no medical knowledge or butcher training of any sort. He was known to use the laundry room where the murder occurred, as he was a janitor. And police assumed that his hand could have written the grimy ransom note. The ransom note was described as grimy, as dirty and whatnot. So since he was a janitor, pretty good chance he had done it in their expert opinion.
Yeah, this is what they wrapped their case
on. Oh, yeah, for sure. Police pressured his wife to implicate him and held him for 48 hours of continuous and brutal questioning. He continuously maintained his innocence throughout and was eventually released on a writ of habeas corpus. He described his experience as such. Oh, they hanged me up. They blindfolded me. I can't put up my arms. They are so sore. They had handcuffs on me for hours and hours. They threw me in a cell and blindfolded me. They handcuffed my hands behind my back and pulled me up on bars until my toes touched the floor. I no eat. I go to the hospital. Oh, I am so sick anymore, and I would have confessed to anything.
And that's how they did it back then.
That's exactly.
And that's why we talked about this so many times. They got their confessions for sure. A lot of false confessions.
And that quote will be important later in the story. It was later determined that Verberg, who was a Belgian immigrant, couldn't read or write English well enough to have written the note. He later sued the Chicago PD and was awarded $15,000, which was no small amount in 1946. And good for him, because fuck them. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Absolutely.
By April, 370 suspects had been identified, questioned, and cleared.
I understand the anger and the whatever when it's a kid like that that's getting killed. Absolutely. I understand that, but they never seem to give a shit if they got the right person.
Well, that's the thing. I want the passion from the police. Get that fucker off the street, but get the right person.
Yeah.
Just grab anybody.
It's like they just want to solve it real quick with whoever they can pin it on.
Yeah, they'll treat the first guy or girl that they get as that person, you know?
Yeah.
Don't decide who it is and make the case fit. You know, make your case and then find the person. Exactly. But that's not how they did it back then.
No, they didn't
at all. It's scary. If they beat the shit out of that guy and tortured him, then absolutely he should be compensated for that. That's disgusting and appalling. And how easily it could have gone the other way, where he spent the rest of his life in jail and they knew damn well he didn't do it. So there had been several confessions by individuals and implications of suspects by acquaintances, but in looking into it, all were proven false at this point. 6 months after the murder of Suzanne Degnan, someone living in the same upscale neighborhood as the Degnans witnessed a man reaching into an apartment through a window. The man fled, pursued by two policemen. When cornered by police, the man pulled out a gun and fired at the officers. After one of the officers fired three shots in return, the suspect lunged at one of the officers, and a struggle ensued. An off-duty policeman named Abner Cunningham was just coming home from a day at the beach when he witnessed the altercation, and he broke a stack of flower pots over the man's head, which kind of just reminds me of an old cartoon from back in the day.
Yeah, that's definite Tom and Jerry
guy on the floor above just throw some shit down. The suspect was 17-year-old William Herons. And when he came back in the hospital, he found out that he was now a suspect in the murder of Suzanne Degnan. William George Herons was born on November 15th, 1928, to George and Margaret Herons, immigrants from Luxembourg. He grew up in the Lincolnwood suburb of Chicago, Illinois. The family was poor, and his parents fought continuously, causing him to wander the streets at all hours in order to avoid being home to hear them fight. He began to commit petty crimes, mostly to entertain himself, he would later state. He stole small things to begin with, never selling or seeking to make a profit. When he was 12 years old, he took a job working in a grocery store. I mean, how times have changed that he took a job in a grocery store.
At 12.
And, you know, it was encouraged back then. After miscalculating a customer's change and shortchanging himself by a dollar, he reached through a stranger's chained apartment door and plucked a dollar bill off the table to even himself up. He began to steal more often and graduated to larger items. He assembled a collection of items like guns, cameras, cocktail shakers, handkerchiefs, jewelry, furs, and radios. When he was 11 years old, he witnessed a couple having sex. When he told his mother about it, she told him that all sex was dirty and led to disease. Later on, he burst into tears and then vomited after kissing his girlfriend. Yeah, I'm sure that did wonders for her self-confidence.
Yeah, no doubt.
That was just how she always pictured it, you know.
That's all odd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it with the moms? Because Ed Gein's mom was the same way.
I guess to try to dissuade your kid from having sex early on, but
yeah, but I mean, they're really turning their stomachs on it with the descriptions they give women. And these are women giving these descriptions. Yeah. That's the scary part. If you haven't heard the Ed Gein episode, go back and listen. It was kind of the same description from his mom. So when he was 13, he was arrested for carrying a loaded 25 handgun. When police searched the Heron's home, they eventually stumbled on his collection of stolen weapons and other items in a rooftop shed on a nearby building. That part of the story is a little weird to me, that they searched his apartment and found his collection on the roof of another building. Like, how the fuck did they get over there?
Yeah, how'd they find that?
They get over there.
Tip or whatever.
All in all, he confessed to 13 burglaries. And he was sent to a correctional facility for wayward boys, the Gibault School in Terre Haute, Indiana. This same institution would house Charles Manson a few years later. After a few months, he was released, but seemed to have learned little, as he was quickly arrested again, this time for theft. He was sentenced to 3 years at the St. Bede Academy in Illinois. While his time in these correctional facilities did little to curb his inclination to commit crimes, it did do some good. He proved to be a gifted student, earning top scores, and he was accepted into the University of Chicago's special learning program at the age of 16, before his release in 1945. He chose to major in electrical engineering. His parents couldn't afford the tuition or the dorm fees, so during his first year, he worked several nights a week as an usher, and he resumed his burglaries. Classmates remember him as being particularly popular with the ladies. He was flying high for perhaps the first time in his life, but it wasn't meant to last.
Back then, you could become an usher and afford college. You can't afford college for nothing these days.
You do a lot more being an usher.
Wow.
By June 26th of 1946, Herons was taking a ballroom dancing class, developing a love of playing chess, and he had an upcoming date with a classmate. They would do to go out that very night, and he needed some cash with which to do so. So he attempted to cash in a $1,000 bond, which he'd recently stolen. But the post office was closed that day. So he did what came natural to him, and he reached in the door of an apartment in an attempt to steal when the police came upon him, which led to his arrest and his ultimate suspicion as being the lipstick killer. His version of events differ from that of the arresting officers, however. Police claimed that he had shot at them, and he disagreed. The officers had fired at him, and that was what caused him to flee. He did have a gun on him, yes, he admitted, but that was only to protect himself from mugging while in a dangerous neighborhood while carrying such a large bond. He had not fired at them. Following his arrest and the police deciding that he was the lipstick killer, to say that his civil rights had been violated would be a major understatement. He was coming in and out of consciousness after having his head cracked with the flower pots. Despite his injuries, he was interrogated nearly constantly for 6 straight days. He was severely beaten, starved, denied an attorney for all 6 of these days. denied the ability to speak to any family, including his parents, despite the fact he was only 17 for four of these days.
Oh, he was a minor, too.
Yeah, still 17. Despite their best efforts, Herons refused to admit guilt in any of the three murders. So, he was strapped to a bed while a nurse poured ether on his junk. You heard that right.
I don't know. Is that burn or something? I've never heard of it.
I don't think it's
all
good.
I've ever heard of ether for is like to put someone out.
I'm assuming it burns like hell. Why else would they do it?
Wow.
He didn't confess. At another point, a detective repeatedly punched him in the stomach while shouting out details from the Degner murder. He still didn't confess. So next, he was injected with sodium pentothal with neither a warrant nor his parents' consent. Two psychiatrists, Haynes and Grinker, gave him the truth serum and then interrogated him for three straight hours. Once under the influence of the drug, they stated that Herons told them about an alternative personality named George, who had actually committed the crimes. When they pushed him for a last name, they reported that Herons had said he couldn't remember the last name, but recalled that it was, quote, a murmuring name, whatever that means. That's a quote. Police shortened that last name to Merman, and when the press got a hold of it, it became George Murderman. Herons' alternate personality who had committed the bad crimes, which he could not remember. The fact that Herons' middle name was George made it all that much more certain that this was a confession. Herons would always state that he remembered almost nothing of the interrogation that occurred while he was under the influence of the drug. But Roy Grinker, one of the psychiatrists that supposedly witnessed the confession, would state in 1952 that Herons had said nothing during that interrogation that implicated himself.
Wow.
Some shady, shady shit going on here.
They got, like we said, they got their confessions. They wanted them. He didn't even confess and they got their confession.
But this is one of the two guys that said, supposedly, that he told him about the George Murderman. Now, this guy is saying that didn't happen. So one of the few people that witnessed this is saying a couple years later, that didn't happen.
Guilt, what, you know?
On the fifth day of his interrogation, he was given a spinal tap without anesthesia. He was then administered a polygraph test, but police found he was in way too much pain to do so, so they pushed it back a few days. On July 12, 1946, 17 days after his initial arrest, 17-year-old William Herons was indicted for assault with intent to kill, robbery, 23 counts of burglary, and 3 counts of murder. Handwriting experts had determined that his handwriting did not match the writing on Francis Brown's wall. His fingerprint matched only 9 of the FBI's 12 points of identification needed for a positive match to a fingerprint, the one that was found in Brown's door jam. The FBI statistics state that the fingerprint recovered would match 65% of the country's population, with only 9 points of identification. On June 30th, 13 days before his indictment, Captain Emmett Evans had actually told the newspapers that Herons had been cleared in the Brown murder because his fingerprints did not match the print recovered. 12 days later, the chief of detectives, Walter Storm, said that that same bloody smudge had been his print after all.
So the
Chicago PD can't even agree. It's not his print, and now it's definitively his print 12 days later. Like, what the fuck is going on?
You're probably going to get into it, but what is it that links these cases together? Is it just that they had a pile of cases that they wanted to, like, is there something special that stands out?
It's a major question in this case, for sure. Maybe I'll get to it, maybe I won't. I'm not leaving you hanging. I'm saying maybe my explanation will answer your question, maybe it won't. Searches of his house and dorm, again without a warrant, didn't find anything that implicated him in the murders. There were definitely items that didn't belong to him, but then again, he had never denied that he was a thief. He had stolen a medical kit, and he had it in his possession. But none of the medical instruments inside had any biological evidence that tied them to the murders. And the instruments within were determined to have been way too small to have been used in any of the murders and dissections. A single eyewitness had seen a figure walking towards the Degnan residence the night of the abduction, carrying a shopping bag. The figure stood about 5'9" and weighed about 170 pounds, and he looked to be about 35 years old. He could not make out the man's face and did not recognize Herons when showed a photograph of him. And the police also had a partial fingerprint off of the ransom note from the Degnan house. It matched Herons on only 9 points on the FBI chart and again matched 65% of the population. Herons' attorneys felt that he was guilty, however. The DAA did not think that he could obtain a conviction. So the DA offered a plea bargain in which Herons would serve only one life sentence if he pleads guilty to all three murders. Herons and his attorneys agreed, and he signed an official confession. A meeting was set at the DA's office where Herons would make his official confession as well as answer questions from the press. But District Attorney Toohey gave a speech beforehand about the truth finally coming out, which upset Herons and caused him to give noncommittal answers, as well as giving the press what he claimed to be, quote, the real truth. The DA withdrew his plea bargain and changed it to three life sentences to run concurrently, as well as...
What's the difference?
There's not really any.
Yeah, I mean, concurrent... all life sentences.
No, but three life sentences that run consecutively would mean one after the other after the other.
Uh-huh.
Three life sentences that run concurrently... is basically one single life sentence because they run at the same time.
Right, but I mean, it's a life sentence, so I mean, you only get one.
I'm guessing.
So what they're saying is you get to die, and if you get reincarnated and come back, you have to go back to jail again two more times.
I think with a single life sentence, though, with they don't say whether parole is possible or whatever.
Parole.
He might be able to get out. Three life sentences concurrently, you're not going to get out. A single life sentence, you might. It's probably more. I think when I get done with the whole thing with Herons, it's he didn't. He didn't do it. Or he's saying, I didn't do it. I'm not going to read any of that shit. So the DA was now saying, so I'm changing it. I'm only going to offer you three life sentences. They got to run concurrently. And I'm going to threaten you with a death penalty if we go to trial. Now, he was prepared to charge Herons with the murder of Estelle Carey if he didn't play ball. Even though he definitely knew that Herons was not in Chicago at the time of her murder, he couldn't possibly have done it. This was at a time where he was at the Gabalt School in Indiana. So, I mean, that shows you how crooked they are right now.
No kidding.
You plead guilty to this shit. I'm just going to throw some shit at you that you didn't even do. I know you didn't do it. The whole lot of them is just so scumfuckish. It's not even funny. So, Herons accepted this second, much less favorable plea bargain. He later said because of his fear of the death penalty. And while it would save him from the death penalty, it would literally cost him the rest of his life. The same day as having entered his guilty plea, he tried to hang himself at the Cook County Jail. He was discovered just in time. He stated that he was in despair over having been viewed as guilty, and if he were dead, maybe that perception would change. Only days after his confession in court, Herons retracted it. He denied that he had any hand in any of the murders. Mary Jane Blanchard, whose mother was Josephine Ross, stated in 1946, I cannot believe that young Herons murdered my mother. He just does not fit into the picture of my mother's death. I've looked at all the things Herons stole, and there was nothing of my mother's amongst them. Herons was sent to Statesville Prison in Joliet, Illinois. He learned several trades on the inside, including electronics repair. He became the first inmate in Illinois history to earn a 4-year college degree, earning a BA. He ended up overseeing the garment factory at Statesville, supervising 350 other inmates. He was transferred several times over the years, generally to lower security institutions. He was repeatedly denied parole, and a petition for clemency was also denied. All told, Herons served 65 years in prison, making him the longest-serving inmate in Illinois history. He attempted suicide 3 times over the years and maintained his innocence throughout. He died on March 5th, 2012 due to complications from diabetes at the age of 83. So was he guilty? Let's get to that.
Doesn't sound like it.
Let's get to that. William Herons was a serial thief with no history of violence of any sort. And none of the three murders was anything stolen. The coroner noted that in the Suzanne Degnan murder that the killer expertly dissected the body with no sign of hacking. The killer showed signs of medical training or experience in butchery, neither of which Herons had. The eyewitness to the Brown murder described a man of 35 to 40. Herons was 17. The eyewitness to a figure walking towards the Degnan camp kidnapping site also reported a man of 35 years old, but he said he couldn't make out the man's face. When shown a photo of Herons, he couldn't recognize him. He told the police darkness prevented him from seeing the man's face, but days later, he was able to identify Herons in court. He now said that Herons had walked into a car's headlights, which allowed for this sudden identification.
How convenient.
Yeah, a couple days later, and you saw him picking him up. Weird. Handwriting expert found no similarities between Herons' known handwriting and the lipstick writing on Francis Brown's walls, nor the ransom note. Nor did they detect any similarities between the note, between the hand that wrote the lipstick message and the one that wrote the ransom note. So they don't detect any similarities between Heron and the lipstick note, nor the ransom note, nor any similarities between the ransom note and the lipstick note. So not only was it most likely that Herons didn't write either of them, it's likely that the guy who wrote on the wall in lipstick and the guy that wrote the ransom note weren't the same guy.
See, not even those two cases were tied. It's like they took these cases and piled. That was my question earlier.
I think the two first murders were the same person. But the person that kidnapped Suzanne Degnan was not.
It sounded completely different.
And William Herons was neither of them. To me, it's almost certain. The results on the polygraph test he was given were at the time reported to have been inconclusive by D.A. Toohey. The results of the test were analyzed by two experts, John E. Reed and Fred E. Inbow, for their 1953 textbook, Lie Detection and Criminal Investigation. And they determined that the results weren't inconclusive at all. They wrote, quote, "Murder suspect William Herons was questioned about the killing and dismemberment of 6-year-old Suzanne Degnan. On the basis of conventional testing theory, his response on the car test clearly establishes him as an innocent person," end quote.
Unbelievable. None of these people had a problem with doing this.
No.
You know? Put him away. Especially when it's a lie detector. If you're a person that administers lie detector tests, you know he's telling the truth.
Well, at no point did they say he was lying. They just said it was inconclusive, which was the best they could come up with because he wasn't lying. But even by saying inconclusive, they were lying because the
expert, that makes him look guilty.
Yeah, it's because the expert said positively he was not lying. So probably the prosecution's most damning evidence against Herons was the fingerprint evidence. But even that is suspect. The fingerprint off Francis Brown's door jamb was only good enough to exclude 33% of the population. It was also noted by some to have looked like it was from a rolled fingerprint, like having come from a police fingerprint index card. This led some to suspect that it was a possible plant. The prints found on the ransom note are equally a suspect. The chain of evidence was repeatedly broken, and the note was handled by both civilians and inexperienced law enforcement. When first analyzed by the Chicago Detection Crime Lab, they couldn't find any usable prints on the note. The note was then sent to the FBI Crime Lab in Washington, where it underwent a process known as iodine fuming, which raised two prints on the front of the note. None were found on the back. They were photographed, as they tend to quickly fade back out. The photos were turned over to Sergeant Thomas Laffey, Chicago PD's fingerprint expert. He stated, "They are so incomplete, it is impossible to classify them." He then checked them against all suspect prints from anyone arrested in the past 6 months, and this would have included Herons. He found no matches. Days later, he announced a match between Herons and two of the prints. Months later, they announced that he had also found a palm print on the reverse side of the note that also matched Herons. The FBI mentioned nothing about a print on the reverse side when they analyzed the note. Before police analyzed the note, it had been given to a crime reporter, which broke the chain of custody in compromising integrity. Charles Wilson, the chief of the Chicago Crime Detection Laboratory, stated, "When we got the Degnan note, it came late, after other people had photographed it and handled it." In the same vein, a March 22, 1946 FBI report noted, "It is evident that the note has been handled considerably. However, Chief Walter Storm stated that no one else but Herons had handled the note."
So So every had fingerprints all over.
Everybody's stating that this this note has been handled by everybody under the sun. Now, the Chicago is initially saying that there's no prints to be found. Everybody's saying that everybody under the sun has handled the note. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, boom, we found three prints, and they all happen to be Aaron's.
And all in the back of the...
So they found two on the front, one on the back. But the FBI crime lab had just handled it and said there was nothing on the back. Now, all of a sudden, Chicago's lab has got, oh, my God, we got a paw print clear on the back, and it belongs to Aaron's. Like, it's so shady, it's not even funny. None of these people were wearing gloves back then. So, I mean, if what the witnesses are saying, this note is fucking covered in prints by half the population. But Chicago PD is now saying there's only a couple, and they belong to Aaron's. Now, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, no kidding.
John E. Douglas is the FBI's most famous criminal profiler, and he was the basis for Clarice Starling's boss, Jack Crawford, in Thomas Harris's novel, The Silence of the Lambs. He met with some of the worst serial killers in history, including Bundy, Gacy, Manson, Edward Kemper, and David Berkowitz. While he didn't work on the Herons case while it was being investigated, he examined all aspects of the case as well as interviewing Herons in prison. He wrote about the case in his 2013 book, Law and Disorder. About the case, he states, "Looking at Herons, I would have considered him too young to pull off a crime of this detail and this sophistication. To make the leap from petty burglaries to violent rapes and murders, he was much too meek and passive. This would be particularly true after we looked into his personal life and saw that there was no precipitating factor to make him change or escalate his pattern of lawless and antisocial behavior. In other words, nothing had changed in his life to induce the emotional trauma or stimulus that might have propelled him to more aggressive and violent behavior. He wouldn't go suddenly from casual, if repeated burglaries, to the murder and mutilation of a six-year-old child, brazenly taken from her own bedroom." And he writes then in italics, quote, "It just doesn't happen like that."
End no, quote. None of it made any sense, dude. It's a total.
But this guy is the most prolific profiler in the world. If there's anybody who can get in the mind of a scum fuck, it's this guy. And he's flat out saying, this ain't the guy. He didn't do it. He couldn't have done it. After going further into the case and analyzing all aspects, Douglas later sums up his opinion as such. "After examining all the available facts and evidence, from my years of experience in profiling and criminal investigative analysis, I no longer believe him to have been a killer. And he spent the vast majority of his life behind bars for nothing. Though he is now beyond our justice, I would happily testify to those beliefs under oath in a court of law."
Too little, too late.
Yeah. So if it isn't obvious by now, I do not think that William Herons was the lipstick killer. None of the evidence points at him whatsoever, and they went along with it anyway. He was a timid thief. He was not a cold-blooded, calculating killer.
No.
He just wasn't that guy. And he's certainly a kidnapping is a sophisticated, well, I mean, it's not sophisticated, but it takes a lot of thought. And he was a timid guy that he didn't have that in his DNA.
No, it doesn't match anything about him. They said they found the guy that they wanted to put it on, and they put it on him.
So you asked earlier about, did they have an alternate suspect? Yes. Turns out police had already been on to a much better suspect early on, but abandoned him to focus on Herons. Richard Thomas was a nurse who was said to possess the medical knowledge necessary to dissect a body. He had a history of sexual abuse against his own daughter and had been convicted of extortion and attempted kidnapping. In his kidnapping case, a note was left, which experts believe closely resembles the note at the Degnan house. And though Thomas actually lived in Phoenix, he had been in Chicago during the time of all three murders. He went back to Phoenix, where he confessed to officers there that he had kidnapped and killed Suzanne Degnan. But by then, police had already zeroed in on William Herons.
Wow, so there was a confession out there and they just let it go because it didn't fit their fucking narrative.
And by the time he confessed, the police in Chicago had already decided that William Herons was their guy. So they disregarded this guy's confession and everything else about it.
Wow.
And they just ran this guy through the ringer. Can I say positively that Richard Thomas was the guy? No, but he checks every box.
He said it was him.
He checks every box. But he spent 65 years in prison, and I don't think he did it. I don't think he did any of them.
No,
but I don't either. I would almost, without a doubt, say the first two murders were the same guy, whoever that was.
Yeah, those two sound the same. The
kidnapping and murder were
they're obviously
a different
the
guy,
same, but
and William Herons wasn't any of them.
Yeah, that's exactly where I stand. Wow.
So that's the case of the lipstick killer.
Guys. Dude got railroaded.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Wow. Well, it's a good case. Poor guy.
It's a pressing case, but yeah.
Yeah. And they never caught anybody for any of those.
That was, he was convicted. That's it. There's nobody else even under the microscope.
Yeah, they didn't
now.
Even look.
No, they
that.
Didn't. Like you said, we had that guy under the microscope at the time he was confessing, but no, they decided it was him. Of course he confessed. You poured ether on his balls.
Yeah, no shit. The dude was
spinal
tapped him. What'd you say, 6 days?
6 days.
Absolutely tortured.
No attorney, no parents.
17 years old.
Yeah.
Absolutely railroaded. So this happened in the 40s. How old was he? Do you know what year he died?
He died in 2012. He was 83.
Still in jail in 2012.
Nobody in Illinois history to this day has served more time in prison. 65 years in prison. And I don't think he was ever guilty of anything more than theft. He should have served 2 months. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He should have been out in 1947.
Unbelievable. Well, interesting case, man. I liked it.
So if you're going to reach in the door of an apartment, you better think it through, man.
No kidding. No kidding. So, all right, guys. Well, we hope you like that story. We are going to go to the fire pit. Now, we're running low. If you guys have any stories, they can be paranormal. They can be about anything that you would talk to your friends around the fire pit. We need the stories. Send them in. It's beyondtheshadows207@gmail.com. All right, guys. Catch you in the fire pit.
Catch you over there, guys.
All right, today's fire pit story comes from Amanda at the One Nothing Podcast. Get an amazing, amazing podcast. Go over there, check it out. This is another one from her.
My other embarrassing story is much more recent. I DoorDash part-time for additional income, and I was at this one restaurant. I'm not going to name it, although you could look it up, and its Google reviews would tell you what it is. But it is a restaurant. They serve chicken wings and things like that. And I was picking up an order one day, and there was a girl in there. I was waiting forever. I finally picked up the order, and I went to leave. And as I was about to open the door kind of swings open away from me. So I have to push it to open it. And as soon as you open the door, there's some parking spaces where people park their cars. And the door is glass. It's a glass pane door, just a typical metal handle. And on the outside of the door from where I'm about to stand, I see a cockroach. Like, just not like a hissing bug like we have in Florida, but like a cockroach. Really gross, and I was like, there was people coming in and out. It was a busy establishment. I don't know why, but I felt like in that moment it was my duty to inform the lady that there was a cockroach on the glass. So I was like, ma'am, can you come here? And she's like, what do you need? And I'm like, no, come here. And I'm kind of like pushing and being quiet and sketchy and like trying to motion for her to come closer. Naturally, she's apprehensive. She's like, what the fuck is this random lady trying to bring me closer? I didn't want to yell at her, so I'm just like, can you just please come closer? Normally, of course, she's like freaked out like everybody else would have been. So she like very carefully steps towards me and it's like, what? And I point at the cockroach, which is on the other side of the glass pane of door that I'm pointing at. And I was like, that's really gross. You should probably do something about that. And she looks at where my finger's pointing, looks at me, looks back at where I'm pointing, looks back at me and then says, the handicapped man? And I was like, what? So I was facing her. So I turn around and through the door, past the cockroach, which she couldn't see from the feet that she was standing from me, there was a man in the parking lot exiting his incapable vehicle and getting into a wheelchair to come inside. So I tried to like spit out some kind of jumbled words of no, I'm pointing at the cockroach, but nothing. I was just embarrassed because I thought in that instant that she thought that I was like stereotyping or being some kind of, I don't know what the word is for it, not being acceptable or not being accepted of incapable people, which isn't the case. But in that moment, I worried that that's what she thought of me. And so I panicked and I jumbled out something about I was looking at the cockroach and she had no idea what I was saying. And I ran out of there and I left the restaurant. I didn't know how to come back for that. My social anxiety, I was having like a panic attack in the parking lot. And I left and I don't know that She looks very basic, so I don't know that if I saw her again, I would recognize her enough to be like, oh, you're that girl. But I, for a long time, I didn't go back in there, and I'm pretty sure to this day she thinks that there's a woman very intolerant of disabled people running around in the city being really judgmental about it and expecting her to do something about it.
It's so Amanda, it's not even funny. I love that story, Amanda. Thanks for sending it in. That one doesn't surprise me. So, guys, if you get a story, it can be anything, just like what Amanda just had given us. That's awesome. So send your stories in to beyondtheshadows207@gmail.com or send them to any of our socials, and we'll get them on the air. So we appreciate you guys, and we will catch you in the next one.
Later, guys.